love is love, and we all need to go that way. That's the way the world needs to be.
Alaskans react to the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 26th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hellman. Also tonight, the site of the plane crash that killed 9 people near Ketchikan is difficult to reach.
The terrain varies from forested area to slides to slippery, muddy slope.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
In a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court today declared same-sex marriage legal in all 50 states. That means the status quo will continue in Alaska, where same-sex marriage was legalized in October. But for Juneau-raised performing artist Seneca Harper, the decision will change how he feels while traveling in the lower 48. He married his partner last year in Washington State.
It's going to be kind of nice to be able to visit more conservative areas of the country and to say, I'm not sorry at all. And to unapologetically exist as who I am with my husband and hold his hand that has a ring on it and be proud of that.
Joshua Decker is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. The ACLU led the first marriage equality case back in 1970, and there were plaintiffs in today's case as well. He says today's decision affirms that same-sex relationships need to be respected everywhere in the nation.
We think that when you look back on today in the future, today's U.S. Supreme Court decision is going to be right up there with Brown versus the Board of Ed when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down segregation in the schools.
But former Lieutenant Governor and state lawmaker Lauren Lehman says including today's decision as a win for the civil rights movement is demeaning to minority groups like Black people and Alaska Natives, who he says really needed civil rights protections. As a state senator, Lehman led the 1998 effort to amend the Alaska Constitution to define marriage as between a man and a woman.
I believe it was so important for Alaska to protect its definition of marriage, which was in statute, but to protect it by constitution. Marriage has always, throughout history, been a union of a man and a woman, and to change the definition into something else is a diminishment of the institution of marriage.
In 1998, almost 70% of Alaska voters agreed with Lehman. Pollsters found public opinion swinging for the first time in favor of same-sex marriage in 2014. Juneau Republican Representative Kathy Munoz sponsored a bill last session that would prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. She sees marriage equality as a step forward.
It recognizes, you know, kind of a basic right. And, you know, I think that's important. It's progress. And I know that a number of people in our community will benefit. And as a matter of fact, I look forward to attending a wedding in August. And, you know, now that this decision has happened, I think they can, you know, have much more to celebrate.
But there's more work to do. Munoz's anti-discrimination bill wasn't heard this year, but she hopes it will get a fair chance in the 2016 legislative session. Recovery efforts were underway early this afternoon for 9 people killed yesterday when a float plane crashed into the side of a steep mountain in Misty Fjords National Monument outside of Ketchikan. KRBD's Leila Carey has more.
8 cruise ship passengers and their pilot died when their flight scene trip to Misty Fjords ended tragically. The de Havilland Otter lost contact about noon that day with its home base at Promec Air, a Ketchikan-based tour company. The authorities immediately were contacted to start searching. The plane soon was spotted on a cliff about 800 feet uphill from Ella Lake, a popular recreation spot with a U.S. Forest Service-maintained cabin. That became the base of operations for the rescue effort. Chris John is incident commander with the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad. He says weather conditions worked against them the day of the crash, plus the crash site was challenging. They used a helicopter to get as close as possible and then started hiking.
It took them about nearly an hour the first time because of conditions and also finding the best route across, because the terrain varies from forested area to slides to to a slippery, muddy slope. And so where you're going across there, you have to gear up for the conditions as you walk along, and including sometimes roping up.
Cruz got to the plane nearly 6 hours after the initial call and discovered that everyone on board had been killed. At that point, it was still raining and starting to get dark, so they pulled back and went home to rest and regroup for a recovery effort the next day. John says crews were back on the scene mid-morning. The weather was better, and they already had a route to the site, so this time it only took about half an hour to hike over to the plane. Once the bodies have been retrieved by helicopter, John says they'll be taken to a U.S. Coast Guard boat and then brought to Ketchikan. From here, the bodies will be flown to Anchorage for examination by the state medical examiner. Alaska State Troopers and the National Transportation Safety Board are investigating the crash. An NTSB team has traveled to Ketchikan, but spokesman Keith Holloway says it will take a while to determine the cause of the crash. There's a lot of information that needs to be gathered first.
You know, looking at the aircraft, looking to see if there are any fractures on the metal of the aircraft, and looking for navigational equipment to see what the instruments were reading at the time of accident. Any clues that we can gain to try to find out what may have caused this accident.
Holloway says the Otter is too small to have a flight data recorder or black box on board, but NTSB will look into communications between the plane and any air traffic control service on the ground. He says weather is a possible factor in the crash. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The Alaska Marine Highway System plans to lay up 3 of its 11 ferries for most of the next year. A draft schedule released today shows the Taku out of service for all of fiscal year 2016, which begins in July. The fast ferries Chiniga and Fairweather will be tied up for most of the fall, winter, and spring. Marine Highway spokesperson Jeremy Woodrow says the schedule reflects state budget cuts as well as vessel repairs.
The main goal is not to cut off any single port from ferry service. So no port will lose ferry service during the winter season, just some will see less frequency.
But several southeast communities will lose service for about 6 weeks. Angoon, Tenakee, Gustavus, Metlakatla, and Pelican will see no ferries from January to mid-February. The ferry system is taking comments on the draft schedule. Teleconferences are planned for July 22nd. A prominent Democrat in the state Senate is calling on Governor Bill Walker to expand Medicaid in Alaska without approval from the legislature. Anchorage Senator Bill Wilikowski says now that the Supreme Court has upheld insurance subsidies in Alaska, there's no reason for the governor not to expand Medicaid.
It's time for the governor to exercise leadership and just do it. And we've got legal opinions saying he can do that, and I think he should do that. I think that's where Alaskans are. That's what Alaskans want. And it's time that he exercise some leadership and just do it.
According to two separate legal opinions written in May, Walker likely has the authority to expand Medicaid without legislative approval. During this year's legislative session and the special session that followed, Republican lawmakers blocked Medicaid expansion from coming to a floor vote. In May, the House Finance Committee declined to advance the Medicaid expansion bill, saying the state needed to reform Medicaid before expanding the program. Polls show a majority of Alaskans support expansion. Wilikowski says when he met with Walker privately during the session, he asked the governor to make the decision on his own.
During session, I had suggested to him that we would probably never run out of excuses from those who oppose it not to do it. And so I felt at some point in time he was probably going to have to go ahead and do it on his own. And I did express that to him.
Through a spokesperson, Governor Walker declined to discuss the issue. When he took office, Walker said Medicaid expansion was one of his top priorities. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a global soccer camp in Juneau goes beyond the basics.
It's like the fancy freestyle side of soccer. So it's like all these flicks you see, all these like you run past the player, it's flair.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Calling all adult learners, attend Reaching Arctic Communities Facing Climate Change Camp July 13th through the 17th in Fairbanks. Deadline to apply is Monday, June 29th at thepolarhub.org. This message sponsored by AINE, Association of Interior Native Educators.
A high-profile case about an alleged child rape from 1978 is at an impasse because of Alaska's old statute of limitations. When David Holthaus retold his story of being raped as a child for lawmakers in February, he had no idea it would set off a chain of events that would lead to filing a police report and publicly naming his rapist in the Anchorage Press last week. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Writer David Holthaus had never publicly identified the person who raped him in Eagle River when he was 7 years old.
I did not want to destroy his life by naming him.
But Holthaus's 2004 article, Stalking the Boogeyman, gives clues, including one to throw people off. According to Holthaus, the perpetrator was a star athlete at Chugiak High School and was profiled in the Anchorage Daily News. As an adult, he moved to Broomfield, Colorado, a Denver area suburb. Holthaus also wrote that his rapist was about 17 years old. Now, Holthaus says he deliberately misrepresented the age and his perpetrator was 14 at the time. In the story, Holthaus describes the traumatic experience, his plans to kill his rapist, and finally confronting him as an adult.
After meeting him in person and hearing him swear to me that he had never raped a child before or after he'd perpetrated the crime on me, I decided that it was possible that he was telling the truth.
There was a caveat, though. Holthaus followed up with a letter which said,
if any other victims come forward at any point in the future, I'm going to write a second article and this one will name you.
Nearly 11 years after writing that letter, Holthaus was in the Alaska State Capitol building sharing his story. He spoke in support of a law that would require public schools to teach sexual abuse prevention. After the talk, Holthaus says two people in the Capitol told him they might know other victims of his rapist.
I was very careful about the way I dealt with the situation. I sort of heard them out. In both conversations, it got to the point where they said, I want to say the name and you tell me if it's the same person.
It was. Holthaus says he felt relieved.
I guess the relief was just in finally knowing. The question of whether or not he was telling me the truth had haunted me for more than a decade, and I felt like I finally know.
Since that day in the Capitol, Holthaus says he's wanted to write the story naming him, but
I needed to meet one-on-one with people and have them tell me their stories for me to feel like I had the information to go through with it.
He tracked them down.
Once I had a couple of leads and a couple of names of kids, now adults, but kids who ran in kind of the same social circle. It took me a couple months, but I could, you know, sort of gently reach out to them and point them to my original piece and say, you know, is this something that you would like to sit down and talk to me about by any chance?
Holthaus says he's convinced his rapist sexually assaulted two other boys and a girl. He's heard about other suspicious incidents as well. KTOO could not reach the man for comment. According to property records, he owns a home in Broomfield, Colorado. Holthaus says he still lives there. Phone numbers associated with the man were out of service. He's not listed in sex offender registries in Alaska or Colorado. Holthaus wrote Outing the Boogeyman in the Anchorage Press for himself.
To just finally tell on him. Just to finally, like give that seven-year-old kid a voice and tell on him.
And to let other survivors know.
No matter how much time has passed, when someone rapes you when you're a kid, they give you the power to avenge yourself. And that power is you know their name and you can use it.
It could be online. It could be in a letter. It could be confronting the person. It could be reporting them to the police. Holthaus has done all of these things. He recently reported the rape to the Anchorage Police Department.
My report alone was not going to prompt a criminal investigation, let alone an arrest or prosecution. But it said that reports like this are still important because if other victims were to come forward, it would help corroborate their accounts.
In 1978, the year Holthouse says he was sexually abused, the statute of limitation on child rape was 10 years. Lawmakers eliminated that time constraint in September of 1992. There's currently no statute of limitation for child rape cases. Holthouse's case may not be viable for prosecution, but if someone comes forward with an incident that occurred after 1982, that's fair game. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
As the U.S. team heads to the Women's World Cup quarterfinals this weekend, a Juneau soccer camp is teaching kids about the global sport. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, let's go.
On the turf at Adair Kennedy Field, a group of Scots and Brits are teaching 145 kids how soccer, or what they call football, is played across the pond. Miley Quigley is part of the 11 to 13-year-old group. She says her favorite thing about the camp is learning new techniques.
I barely knew any tricks before, and now I know a lot of tricks because Spider-Man taught us.
The amazing Spider-Man taught us a lot.
Spider-Man is the nickname for Stephen Paris, a sports coach major from Glasgow, Scotland. He doesn't play competitively due to an old foot injury, but that doesn't stop him from teaching the sport. His signature move is called a rainbow.
So stand back a tiny bit and I'll show you. So you're going to roll and flick with your back heel right over the head. I just went right over the reporter's head there.
That was a close one.
Challenger Sports sends foreign players, like Paris, to different parts of the country to teach regional techniques. Last year, a Brazilian group taught samba dribbling.
It's like the fancy freestyle side of soccer. So it's like all these flicks you see, all these like, you run past the player, it's flair.
Hamza Butte is known to his students as Coach Hamburger.
Do not kick the ball. Guys, back now, 5 seconds, one.
He can be pretty strict on the field, which he says comes from his background playing semi-professional soccer in England. Unlike samba dribbling, the British style is more buttoned up, strategic.
You've got to be much more technical, and the game's so technical now, teams want an individual who has everything to his game, passing, dribbling, crossing, shooting.
Typically, soccer teams are an international patchwork, but in the World Cup, athletes play for their home country. Coach Butte says the kids here at camp are watching.
For example, Rapina, the U.S. Winger, women here within the camp, they want to be like Rapina. And whilst they're dribbling the ball, they say it's Rapina. Rapina's dribbling the ball. So they try to imitate these players.
I like Megan Rapinoe. Abby Wombat from the USA team.
I like the one with the same last name as me.
But player Mary Newman says it can be tough to find equality on the field, especially when you're teammates with preteen boys. They hurl what they think is the ultimate insult. You play like a girl.
It's kind of really, honestly, sexist when they say, like a girl, because we're all like, why?
Because these soccer players know what it really means.
Then you must be doing something really good if it's like a girl, because we're way better.
The last time the U.S. men's team reached the World Cup quarterfinals was in 2002. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Josh Edge.
This week on AK, Boat Journey. Every year, dozens of boats travel back to Bristol Bay. Some ride on tenders or cargo ships, and some steam themselves around False Pass, a 1,000-mile journey that can be treacherous. But dozens of boats from Homer and Kodiak take a different route across the Chigmit Mountains on the Alaska Peninsula. KDLG's Molly Dishner tagged along with a captain and crew, bringing their 32-foot drift boat back to the bay after a winter of maintenance in Homer.
After a round of hugs to family staying behind, the fishing vessel Eagle Claw leaves Homer at 10 a.m. sharp on a recent Saturday morning. We're setting off on a five-day journey. First we'll cross Cook Inlet, then we'll take a 15-mile road over a mountain past Iliamna Lake before navigating down the shallow Quijack River. Skipper Louis Flora, who has made the trip three times, says Cook Inlet is one of his favorite parts.
This is probably the most beautiful spot, I think, along the trip.
Flora has fished Bristol Bay since he was a kid in the 80s. His dad built the boat in the late 70s. Most years, the boat winters in King Salmon. But this year, he had it back in Homer so he could work on it. By early evening, we've dropped anchor and joined a line of boats between Inniskin Bay and Iliamna Bay, waiting to get towed over the road. Flora's not in a hurry. There aren't any reports of big catches yet, just boat work waiting to be done. A day will pass before the Eagle Claw is hauled out at Williamsport. Louis's brother and fishing partner, Jonathan Flora, is on board as well.
Yeah, another day of waiting and roasting.
The boat is one of half a dozen in line here at the base of the Chigmit Mountains. While we wait, we play card games, Jonathan's least favorite pastime, and canoe to shore for hiking and swimming. I can't get over how gorgeous our waiting spot is. Eventually, we're hauled out. I climb in the cab with Ray Williams, who's driving truck.
How long have you been driving this?
Oh, that's a good question right off the bat. I can't answer. I think since 72. 71 or 72.
This business is in Williams' blood. His dad started hauling goods along this route more than 70 years ago, mostly groceries and mail from Cook Inlet to Iliamna Lake. Eventually, fishermen decided to see about getting their boats towed over the road. Williams says he did 120 hauls last year, a record. It's an hour and a half up the bumpy 15-mile dirt road. We arrive in Pyle Bay, where the family offers hot showers, clean towels, and internet.
We got a router in the yard here now. We left out here the other night about 1 o'clock. Man, the place was lit up.
Ray's son Chet backs the Eagle Claw and another Homer boat, the Independence, into Iliamna Lake, one at a time. The sun is setting across the lake by the time the boats are docked there. We spend a full day waiting for another Homer boat to join us. Captains talk engines, crew members enjoy Wi-Fi and swimming. It's one of the last slow moments before the fishery begins. But Independence crew member James O'Connor says it's hard to enjoy it.
Well, it's kind of tough to know that you're going to start working soon. Just kind of anxious, I guess, a little bit. It's kind of a weird medium between hanging out but getting ready also. So
Tuesday morning, the Eagle Claw wraps up with the Independence and another drifter for the 70-mile trip across Iliamna Lake. We scan the shore for signs of the villages there and look at the rocks that jut up out of the lake. We drop anchor late that evening, just above the Quijack River near Iliamna. The next morning, Louis points the boat down the Quijack for the only white-knuckle part of the trip. A set netter I meet in Pyle Bay, named Bryce, tells me about the infamous Quijack braids.
And sometimes you have to get out and push. We do.
Did that happen last
year? Yeah. Just one spot, though.
But like most boats, we won't brave the braids alone. Our guide, George Riddles, jumps on board before we reach the Quijack's braids. He takes over navigation.
Around this corner to the right, we're going to give the corner a little bit of respect and then come in pretty tight on the bank.
The shallowest reading is about 1.4 feet. The boats make it through without issue, but we see others traveling that morning that aren't so lucky. Then it's another 8 hours or so down the river. The Quijack turns from clear green-blue to muddy. As we near the mouth of the river, we travel past a shut-down cannery and active set net sites. Eventually, we spot a line of boats on the horizon, the Quijack Tenderloin. We're back in Bristol Bay. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Will Ross, an Anchorage resident who was born and raised in Alaska. From Mount Marathon to Johnson Pass, he's constantly pushing himself in the state's great outdoors.
my main sport is off-road triathlon or the Xterra style triathlon. So definitely do a ton of swimming, a ton of running, lots of mountain running. Like I've been doing mountain marathon since I was 13. In the junior race, you only go halfway, but it was totally, totally scary. Had no idea what I was getting myself into the first year. I'd only hiked it once, and it was the day before. Hadn't really picked out my route yet. The biggest thing at Mount Marathon is you got to pick out your route. Which trail you're going to go up? Are you going to go up the cliff? Are you going to go up the routes? I certainly don't like being passed, so that's one way I push through. There's no oxygen in your brain to think with. So yeah, you're just suffering. I mean, it hurts. You got to prepare for it to hurt, but it's fun. It's an amazing place. So many different things to do outside. And yeah, biking, hiking, skiing. I mostly do the mountain biking, and then now that snow biking has taken off, I've been getting into that. You're not nearly as restricted. Road bike, you basically have to ride the thing on roads. Mountain bike, you gotta stick to the trails. Fat bike, man, you can go anywhere. You can ride beaches, you can ride across tundra. You can ride anywhere, and year round too. The wow moment is every day. It's every time you have a view. You get to the top of a hill and you look around, or ride a new trail and you see the new view, the new lake that you're looking at, or new mountain. Yeah, just anytime you have a different perspective, that's pretty amazing.
Will Ross lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Molly Dishner, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter @APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu, Ed Schoenfeld, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Leila Carey in Ketchikan. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a fantastic weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.